Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 4 in our series on the Book of Daniel. It keeps messing me up because the lesson number, because of the introduction, is greater than the chapter number. So, anyways, lesson number 4 in the Book of Daniel, chapter number 3 in the Book of Daniel, we'll be covering today. And we will be looking at the story of the fiery furnace. If you grew up in church, you know this one by heart. But we're gonna go through it and talk a little bit about it. So, to summarize the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar is going to build a great image and a great statue. Great image, that's what I said in the previous lesson, talking about the statue. But he's going to build a great statue and demand everyone worship it. Well, in all the kingdom, 3 Hebrews do not. And that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of course. And they face the king's wrath, are thrown into the fiery furnace, and delivered by God. So there we go. End the story. We can end this in less than a minute and a half. Woohoo! No, you're not that lucky. Hold on. Buckle in. I don't think this will take an hour, but we're going to go through and look at chapter number 3 of the Book of Daniel. as far as the setting for this, there's really no time frame given in the book. Nothing to tie it down. Doesn't say, you know, in this year, the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. The assumption by many people is that it's around 20 years later. Nebuchadnezzar ruled for about 40, and this would kind of put in the middle. It's kind of a safe thing to do, but there's really not a good way to base this at any specific point in time, so we'll just estimate and say it's been about 20 years. It's been a while. Excuse me. I thought I had my throat all cleared out before I started recording. So we'll see now in verse number 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image, that's a statue, of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So a lot of stuff to kind of digest here. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, of course, yeah, we know that. An image of gold, this giant statue, probably not solid gold, probably gold-plated. This would be a tremendous amount of gold. Not that they might not have it, but it'd just be a whole lot simpler, and they did this kind of stuff. There's evidence of people doing, like, plating statues, so probably gold-plated. 60 cubits and 6 cubits. Basically, this thing is 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. This is a very large statue. The proportions make it a little bit stretched out tall. It's going to be a statue of like a man or some type of god or something. But those proportions are not quite to scale. So this thing's pretty tall and skinny. He sets up the plain of Dura on a plain where, you know, people can see it for a greater distance in the province of Babylon. So nearby to Babylon, there's a little bit of debate over where that plain is, but there's a lot of places around there that would be great to set up something like this. Verse number 2. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Now, normally I would sink into the history and tell you about, ooh, who's the princes? Who are the governors? Who are these captains? And tell you about who all these people are. In this case, just to keep from boring you, and also because I think it's not as important as to who these people were, just to get the idea that everybody is there. So for simplicity's sake, he's called together anybody who's a ruler, who has power, who has authority, to come and meet him at this image. Verse 3. Then the princes, the governors, the and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces. So I just love the flow of all that stuff. Were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So they all stand, you know, they're ready. Everyone's there. The king's up, you know, I imagine the king on a platform standing in front of this giant statue, this crowd of people standing in front of him. In verse number 4, Then and Harold, someone to make this announcement, cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages." And I like that because, you think about Babylon is a conglomerate of so many people that have been, conquered. And that, to the people in general, just the mass of people, to the nations, that's those individual people, ethnic groups, and then the languages. Everybody speaks all these different languages. So basically, they're addressing everybody. Kind of like we would say, ladies and gentlemen, they say, oh, people, nations, and languages. Verse 5. That at what time ye hear, here's another one of these great little flow things, the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. So when you hear the orchestra play, it's time to bow down and worship, give reverence to this image that the king has set up. Now, once again, are we going to track down and tell you what all these different instruments are? No, we're not, because in some cases we have no idea. These are ancient terms for instruments, and we could guess in some cases, but we're just going to call it the orchestra. When the orchestra starts playing, they had trumpets, they had flutes, they had harps, they had various stringed instruments and different things. So just when the orchestra plays, it's time to worship. Now, what is going on here with this? There's a lot of debate about it. Now, I think after studying this a little bit, and we'll get into it here in a few verses down, I don't think this is religious in nature. I think there's something else going on with this, that this is a test. This is a test to see who is loyal. That this is a test to see, if you bow down and worship this image, this idol, and if you don't worship this idol, then evidently you're not a faithful citizen to the empire. That's what I take this as, like a loyalty test, that this is more political than it is religious. Now, you can disagree, and I'll show you some of the evidence for it later on. There are some clues, evidently, and I hate to even mention this because I really didn't feel strong enough about to even put it in the notes, but there is some account, evidently, of a rebellion that takes place under Nebuchadnezzar that had to be put down, and which may explain this type of test being given. We just put down this rebellion, so let's see who's really still with us. And this is a loyalty test to see who will still be loyal to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar. And we'll get down here in a little bit, and verse 14 gets a little bit more explained, a little bit about where I'm coming from with some of that, if that just sounds totally off the wall to you. So verse 6, what happens if you don't worship? Well, there's a consequence. Verse 6, and whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So you will be executed, death by furnace, if you do not do this. So, I mean, this is pretty major. And see, what's funny is there's a little bit of religious tolerance to Babylon. In fact, a lot of polytheistic cultures were pretty lenient with other religions because, they would see similarities or just adopt, these gods in with their gods. And so this is really out of character for a polytheistic society to be doing some kind of test like this, if this was religious. But this death by fiery furnace, I got some notes on that. It's not uncommon in history. It's not extremely common. I mean, it's not like, hanging and firing squads. We think of those as like, those are just the way we've done it for a few hundred years, or guillotines or stuff like that, it's not quite that popular. But there is evidence, there is evidence for burning people and burning people alive and things like that as punishment. That's all throughout history that's happened. The Code of Hammurabi, we've talked about Hammurabi in the very first lesson, kind of a predecessor in the more ancient days of Babylon. In his code, the compilation of laws, has execution by burning twice. In the history of Babylon, there was a rival named Remsen who was executed by burning. Now, was it in a furnace, any of that? We don't know for certain. Could it have been? Yeah, it could have been. They could have been tied to a stake, too, you know. But death by fire, death by burning is not unknown. But and even death in a furnace is not unknown. Now, even in more recent times, the last few hundred years, there's cases of this, but they probably got the idea from this chapter, so I hate to use those. I was looking for ancient examples, and there are a few. Not a lot, but it's not uncommon. And we'll talk about the furnace real quick. Go ahead and get this out of the way. What type of furnace would this be? Well, the furnaces in Babylon, they had them, these giant like brick kilns and different things. They would use it to refine metal, to make bricks, bake the bricks, make glass. The technology they had at the time could probably reach about 2,000 degrees. Just to give you an example, cremation today, you know, they burn a body and turn it into ashes. That's about 1,400 to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit on all that. So, I mean, they could get hotter than we cremate bodies. That's what I won't say. You know, when talking about burning stuff up, this was plenty hot enough. I have a picture I drew that's in the notes when I get that out. It's very cute. But if you imagine like a giant brick kiln, if you ever seen a brick kiln or a big pizza oven even would work this, but it's kind of round in shape, kind of goes up kind of like a cone and has an opening at the top where the smoke and stuff would go out. But the base is a little bit broader and more rounded, and oftentimes there'd be a door in the side of that where you could, you know, reach in and move stuff and everything. Sometimes big enough to move people in and out of. There is some reports I saw that said some of these things were as big as city blocks in ancient Babylon. That was something I wasn't confident enough to put in the notes, but I'll just mention it and just say I saw that, but just really wasn't confident enough in the source to really list it. But, you know, I saw it, so we'll just say that. So there we go. That's burning up in the fiery furnace. So verse number 7. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, so the orchestra plays the music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So here comes the time, the orchestra starts playing, da 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 da, or whatever the musical cue was, and all this great crowd that's been assembled, they all bow down in reverence to this statue. Now, like I said, I think this is some type of political test, and they're looking to see who won't do it. Well, it looks like pretty much everybody did it, they think. But in verse 8, we see that that's not the case. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. And that's what the enemies of God always do. They, you know, they go and slander behind their backs. They accuse. That's what I look at that word, and that's what I think of is like a slander, lied about. In this case, though, they're telling the truth. Verse 9, they spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. So you got to butter up the king, you know. Verse 10, thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. Verse 11, whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So it's like, hey, king, remember that decree you just made a few verses before? We're going to rehash it for you. Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar's like, yes, yes, I remember. I just told you that about three verses ago. So verse 12. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They have not. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now, the little key words in here. Verse 14 is the main one I use to make my case that this is political, not religious. But right here, you can see a little bit. They hadn't regarded thee, that they didn't listen to you. Not they didn't worship the God. They didn't listen to you, Nebuchadnezzar the king. They didn't serve thy gods. So, it says that they serve not thy gods. So it says these Jews don't serve your gods. Well, yeah, the king probably ought to know that. You know, he's already seen Daniel. That shouldn't shock him. This doesn't. But I think what they're trying to say, these people are outsiders. They're really not on board with us Babylonians. And it says they don't worship the golden image. Notice how that's separated out from serve thy gods, worship the golden image. That's shown as two different things there. I mean, you can say, oh, well, it's tied together. No, I think it's separated out in the language that's used as two different things. Verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar hears the news. What does he do? Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. So, judgment day. We brought in the accused before the king. Verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? So, first thing he does, notice there, he separates out. You don't serve my gods. You're not one of us. You're not a Babylonian. You know, you're not all in with me. You're not true blue. And you didn't worship the image. I mean, it's kind of separated out. You know, you didn't worship the golden, my gods, nor, worship. You know, it's kind of separated. It's two different offenses. Verse 15. Now, if ye be ready that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made. Well, it's like, hey, good. You know, I'll give you another chance when you hear the music. Great. If you'll listen, that's fantastic. But if you worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar is getting a little bit of big head. He's going to face that here in a couple chapters. But Nebuchadnezzar looks down at them and says, boys, we're going to cue the orchestra one more time. You're going to bow and worship, or you're going to burn in the fiery furnace. And guess what? No one can save you. You know, you think your God is going to save you. You know, I'm the king. I'm the conqueror. I rule over everything. My gods are awesome. And you are going to burn if you don't worship. I mean, he holds that threat over him. Verse 16. I like that. Who's that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? He's going to see who that God is here in a little bit. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Careful, means that they're, it's not that they're, we don't have to take time. We don't have to think about this. You know, mind's already made up. We're not worried about what we say. You know, they've already made up their minds. They've taken a stand. This is who they are. This is their principles, their beliefs. They don't have to think about it. So it's like, king, hold it right there. We already know what we're going to tell you. Verse 17. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. So it's like, if God wants us to, he can deliver us. But I like this, verse 18. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. So what are they doing? They're standing on their Jewish beliefs. You know, not having a graven image, one of the Ten Commandments, not worshiping idols, even though I do believe whatever's going on is more political than religious. And this time, political systems and religious systems, melded together. So there wasn't something about worship and idol worship involved. But, I don't think that was the main motivation. But anyway, they say, look, God can save us, but if not, doesn't matter. We'll go to our graves knowing we didn't compromise, that we stayed true, to who we are, to what we believe. Now, that reminded me so much when I was reading that of the book of Job in chapter number 13. And I don't have this marked, but I'm going to flip over there to it. Chapter 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, but I will maintain mine own ways before him. I like that. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. That's the same kind of faith that we see the Hebrew children. Now, I want to say Hebrew children. I said this is 20. These guys are probably 35, 40 years old at this time. But just Sunday school teachers, you get in your mind that all these guys are little kids or teenagers. These guys are probably about 40 years old. And Daniel, when he's thrown in the fiery furnace, was probably about 90. So, just to really blow your mind. So, but anyway, these Hebrew guys say, look, king, doesn't matter. We're not doing it. Verse 19. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. So he is hot. I imagine, like, you know, Donald Duck does in the cartoons, his face goes red, the steam comes out of his ears, you know, he is hot. And the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, he's so hot visibly, you can see the veins stick out of his neck, and his face turned red. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. So he's like, get the thing hot and stoke it up, fire it up, and get it as hot as you possibly can. The 7 times was, you know, honestly, is it even physically possible for them to get 7 times hotter than 2,000 degrees? Probably not their time. But figuratively speaking, it is, I mean, make the thing glowing hot. Have you ever, we used to have a wood-burning stove in our old house, and you put, you know, get your fire started in there, and if you got it hot enough, you could see it kind of start turning red and kind of start glowing. And you usually couldn't hardly stay in the room, but yeah, I've seen that happen a few times, you know, and even, you know, different other cases like grills and different things. But that old stove we used to have, I saw it kind of get a glow to it because it was so hot. So I can imagine, you know, just how hot this furnace is. And I also, just as a little comedy note here, there is one thing that is hotter than that furnace, and that was Nebuchadnezzar. Let's see. Here we go. Verse 20. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. So he says, okay, you know, get the Green Berets, the Army Rangers, Special Ops. Give me the biggest, strongest guys we've got. We're not taking any chances. I want the best of the best, the biggest, the strongest, the bravest to tie these boys up and throw them in that furnace. Let's see, here we are. 21. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So why is that detail given? Most of the time in ancient days, when they executed someone, they strip them down naked. When Christ was crucified, he was naked. They stripped their clothes off of them. The fact that they left their clothes and their hats on them just means they were in a hurry. It's like, let's don't take time to strip these guys down. Just tie them up and throw them in. That just shows how mad Nebuchadnezzar is. He's just throw them in. Get rid of them. Verse 22. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the fire is so hot, those men tasked with throwing them in the furnace are overcome by the heat and the smoke and the flames, and they themselves die throwing these guys in. So you think, oh my goodness, there's no hope for the guys they actually did throw in, who actually got inside the furnace, not just the guys who got to the door and threw them in. I mean, these guys that were inside, they're done. They're cooked, you would think. Verse 23. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So, you know, you kind of hear the devil laughing. You know, he thinks he's got the victory. Is these three guys are in there, and that would be the end under normal circumstances. But you remember what Nebuchadnezzar himself asked and says, who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? That God showed up. Verse 24. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished. That's astonished. In fact, normally I will read that as astonished, okay? Just to cut down on confusion. And rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. Verse 25, he answered and said, lo, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. So as they throw him in, Nebuchadnezzar says, and he's waiting. I just mad. You know, he's taking pleasure in this. Yes, you know, I'm punishing these people who will not listen to me. But a miracle happens as he watches and just expects them to, you know, writhe in anguish as the flames, you know, tear apart their bodies. Instead, these guys are loose and they're moving around and walking around in the fire just like they would in their own living room. And there's not just three guys, there's four. And the king has to ask, hey, how many guys we throw in? They said, hey, it was just three, right? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that's right. And the king said, well, I see a fourth. It's very interesting. He says, is like the Son of God. How does he know that? He's a pagan. He's a polytheist. You know, Christ himself will not be born for hundreds of more years. How does he know that that's a son of God? Now it's like, well, maybe he's talking and said, well, he's saying it's an angel or something like that. How do you know what an angel was? He knew something supernatural was going on. I think deep down, he just knew. He looked down in there and he knew that's the Son of God. That's Jesus. I think it is programmed in mankind who God is and who Jesus is. And I think it's there. I don't think you have to teach people to be to believe in God. You have to teach people to be an atheist. And science has proven that. Psychologists have proven the areas of the brain, are just wired. You know, they light up when you think about God. I mean, it's just, you are wired that way. And I think whether through supernatural means or maybe just, like I say, maybe it's just pre-programmed into the human mind. When he saw who that was, that fourth person, he knew. He didn't know, oh, it's Jesus Christ. He's going to be born of a virgin. And let me give you a doctrinal dissertation on who this guy is. But he knew that's the Son of God. He knew who that fourth person was. That's what I think. You know, when the Bible says every knee will bow before Christ, no one's going to have to stand around and say, hey, who's that guy up there we're bowing down to? They'll know. And I think in this case, he knew when he saw Christ who it was. That's my opinion. 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth, that's the door, the opening, of the burning fiery furnace, and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. So Nebuchadnezzar himself goes down there and says, hey, boys, come on out. Says, continuing, then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. In verse 27, and the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of the fire had passed on them. So when they examined these men, the only thing that was burned, the only thing that was gone, was the ropes that bound them. Their hair of their head, you know, hair is very susceptible to fire. In fact, you know, every time I grill, I singe the hairs all over my hand, probably because I'm not very good at grilling. But even the hair, their coats didn't even smell like smoke. There was no reason to believe these men had ever even been near a fire, let alone inside one. That's the level God protected them to. Verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel, his messenger that's given there, and delivered his service. And that's another case like, well, the fourth person in there was an angel and the Son of God. You know, hey, you can believe that. I think, you know, and by the way, study this out. Angel of the Lord can refer to Christ in the Old Testament. Boy, that's a big study. And delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. So Nebuchadnezzar knows when he's licked and knows when he's beat and says, whoop, something supernatural has gone on here. And their God just saved them. There's no other explanation for this. And that God saved them because, you know, for them being faithful, staying true to him. Verse 29, therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill. He must like that, chopping people up and turning their houses into dunghills, because there's no other God that can deliver after this sort. So he's like, wow, I'm impressed. This God must be so important. Don't anybody say anything bad about this God, and don't anyone mention anything bad about him at all. Because this God, who else can deliver like this God can? Now, is he a Christian now? Is he a Jew now? No, he's not. He's still saying this is a mighty God amongst many gods. He's still a polytheist in how he's looking at this situation because there's no other God that can deliver. He's not saying there is no other God. He's saying there's no other God that can do this. Verse 30. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So what happens after all this? Just like he did with Daniel, when Daniel revealed the dream, he takes those three guys and promotes them, gives them more prestige, gives them more power, gives them more wealth, You need M&M's. I got interrupted by my baby girl who says she needs M&M's. Go ask mommy. All right. I guess I need to hurry up because my wife's back from shopping. All right. Last thing. That was the last verse. I really did very good. A couple last little points I want to cover. Question is always asked, where is Daniel during all this? Well, A, it doesn't matter. But then again, had he been around, had he been subject to this, there's not a doubt in my mind he would have been in that furnace with them. That's the kind of man he was, the kind of integrity that he had. So where was he? Different theories. One is that he's away in a different province, a different area, a different city on business. Could be the case. He's not there. Perhaps he is exempt from this because he is so high ranking as, one of the top advisors to the king. Perhaps this is just for the underlings, the below him. So, he's standing by the king as all this is going on, and he doesn't have to. Maybe he counseled against it. We don't know. It's just not mentioned. Another theory is that maybe because he is so powerful that he didn't do it, but everyone knew you don't accuse Daniel because it's pointless, it's useless, so you go after everybody else. So regardless, like I say, I don't think it's important to know exactly what he was doing or where he was, because this man, his integrity and his character and his faith in God, he would have, if he had been in the situation with those guys, he would have taken the exact same route and been in the furnace with them. And last of all, this chapter is kind of skipped over in some commentaries, skimmed over because I say, hey, there's no prophecy here. We like the book of Daniel for prophecy. Well, is there a little prophecy? I'm not necessarily prophecy, but I would say there's a principle here. And that is God protects his own people. Even in times of Gentile domination, God still takes care of his chosen people, the Jews. He still preserves them. He keeps that remnant around. For hundreds of years, there in the Old Testament, from this Babylonian captivity all the way up to the time of Christ, they were underfoot of many different empires, of the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, and various iterations thereof. After the temple's destroyed in 70 AD and after the final revolt in 130, the Bar Kokhba revolt, and Israel's wiped off the map and it's now called Syria-Palestina. Even after that, for thousands of years, until 1948, when the state of Israel the nation of Israel is reestablished, did God neglect his people? Did God forget about them? No, he's preserved those people. So I would say that in this chapter, in this story, is there prophecy? No, but I think there is a very important principle you need to keep in mind in prophecy, and that is God does not and will not forsake his own. And in this case, with the nation of Israel, because all prophecy revolves around Israel, he will not neglect his people. He will not leave them unprotected. And doesn't mean trials and tribulations and things like the Holocaust won't come. It don't mean that they won't wander around the world without a homeland and face persecution and prejudice. But they're still around. How many other cultural, ethnic groups from 2,000 years ago are still around with that same identity? Not just living in a country with the same name, but with the same identity, worshiping the same God. Though they don't really exist. Israel is an amazing, amazing testimony to God preserving and protecting his own people. And lastly, I'll go and point out to you, is this a little glimpse even? In the book of Revelation, it talks about 144,000 that are sealed, that are protected during the tribulation period. And they're not Jehovah's Witnesses, they're Jews. It's quite clear. Revelation chapter 7, verses 3 through 8. 12,000 from each tribe. 12,000 of each tribe times 12 is 144,000. Do we get a little glimpse of them? God takes those few people who take a stand, who don't receive the mark of the beast, who don't go along with the Antichrist, and God protects them. That's kind of like what he did with these three Hebrew guys way back thousands of years before. when they took a stand and said, we won't worship, we won't bow, and God protected them through the fires of persecution, maybe we kind of see a little example of how God works, and maybe we see a little foreshadowing of things that even will still come in the future, in the end times that Daniel is going to spend a lot of time talking about. So there we go. Let's wrap it up. I appreciate you listening today. I kind of feel like I rushed through this because I did kind of rush through it because I knew I was kind of running short on time and I did get interrupted by my really cute little 2-year-old girl. But anyway, I appreciate you listening and kind of easy to fly through this one. But anyway, I appreciate you listening. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. And that's it. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you.